Those who don't know me, Jamie is Vista. I head the humanitarian NGO partnerships division with the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and Australia's Australian government's humanitarian coordinator in terms of advising on how Australia responds to a range of different humanitarian crises. I think it's fantastic we've got the session we have this morning, considering the types of humanitarian crises we are facing today and the different types of challenges we face in dealing with those. I think we've got three very sort of interesting presentations. One particularly sort of looking at how humanitarian assistance is provided in the Pacific context and some of the challenges that come with that in terms of Wontok cultural sort of perspectives, and particularly from Carl Adams from Tear Fund New Zealand. It's great to also have somebody from a perspective from New Zealand. From my experience working in the Pacific, New Zealand brings a very unique and very important understanding and contribution to the challenges and work within the Pacific region. So welcome, Carl. Olivia Warwick, we've got a presentation particularly looking at some of the challenges around how we better invest and look at the forecasting and investments in disasters, trying to obviously then limit or mitigate the impacts that can come from that, both in terms of sudden onset but also slower onset crises like we saw with El Nino. It hit the Pacific 12 months ago. And then finally, a presentation from Rim Malakati. Rim is a research associate here at ANU, and he's going to be presenting on some of the challenges and opportunities for how humanitarian assistance is provided to refugees, particularly in Lebanon. I was there a bit over 12 months ago, and as you know, the Australian government's got a very ambitious agenda about how we support refugees in response to the Syria crisis, with education being one of the sort of key focuses. So I look forward to hearing from that. So I'll the format, we're going to sort of give 10 to 15 minutes to the presenters. They've all got PowerPoints to sort of talk through, and then I'll give 5 to 10 minutes opportunity for questions for each of them, and then hopefully leave a bit of time for broader general questions before the end.
Is this a pointer? Good morning, everyone. I'm Carl. I came across from Auckland in New Zealand, and my affiliations are with University of Auckland and also with a New Zealand-based NGO called Tear Fund. Today I'd like to discuss a topic which I'd researched, or which was part of my research a couple of years ago, looking at the role of MPs as humanitarians in response to floods which happened in the Solomon Islands a couple of years ago. So I understand that Australia has quite a close relationship with Solomon Islands, so a few of you may have been there or involved at that time, and I think a lot of people will have remembered the photos and stories which were coming out during those floods. So just as a really brief overview, the floods happened in April of 2014, which followed a few days of really heavy rain, with a total of 22 deaths, and there was a lot of crowding of evacuation centres, which at their peak housed around 10,000 people. One of the less visible but quite significant impacts were that about three quarters of the food crops were destroyed on Guadalcanal province, and also neighbouring provinces were pretty hard affected as well. And then in the couple of months following the disaster, there was also an outbreak of rotavirus, which caused 18 deaths and infected quite a lot of people. So as I kind of mentioned before, there's a lot of concentration of the of impacted areas in rural areas, which were kind of, I guess the media really picked up on the big impacts which happened along the Matanikau River and in the town. And those areas were quite difficult to access in the early days and weeks following the disaster. And some of the NGOs who I talked to, had teams who were walking on foot for a couple of days to reach some of the more remote areas. These are some of the photos which were covered pretty extensively in the media at the time. Why I put the picture of the bridge in there is that a few people relayed that was a pretty significant, achievement that bridge actually didn't go down during the disaster. There's two bridges which connect the west and the east of Honiara, and the one upstream had had been completely destroyed. And if this bridge had have gone as well, then the two sides of the town would have been broken, would have been separated, and made logistics quite a challenge. So I'd like to discuss the notion of MPs as patrons of disaster, and look at three key areas. Over the past couple of years, there's been a number of disasters which have hit Solomon. So the floods is what I focused on, but there are also there was a cyclone Raquel, which was a low category cyclone, which happened when I was doing the field research for this, and also the likes of cyclone Pam, and more recently earthquakes as well. So three areas are overt clientelism. So there's really strong client patron relationships in Solomon Islands, which are quite framed around the One Talk system, literally meaning one talk or people of the same kin networks. So that really forms a base of governance and perceptions of governance in Solomon Islands. And in the disaster, a lot of aid relief was actually channeled directly through members of parliament who were given funds to respond in their constituencies. So as you can imagine, that has a number of different implications, and so MPs having the power to decide who receives relief supplies, what and how much, has a number of implications. And then also looking at the question of governance, on what informs governance more strongly, networks of patronage or the government policies as well. So the field research which I conducted was in three different areas. Mamanawata, which is, for those familiar with Solomon Islands, is a settlement at the mouth of the river which burst its banks. A community down in Lunga, which is quite near to the Ramsey base, and down in Aralego district, which is down to the west of the province. So my research looked to investigate the ways which disaster is both informs and is informed by the experiences of people on the ground. So specifically looking at the roles which NGOs played and affected communities. So forming the basis of the research, there were 23 interviews with 17 different government and non-government stakeholders, civil society organisations, and some foreign embassies who were there, and also 12 focus group discussions across those three communities, which were divided up by both age and gender. So, as I mentioned before, the reciprocity is quite strong in Solomon Islands and really forms the basis of a lot of the governance structures. A lot of my research participants relayed that state institutions they perceived were quite personalised. So they had, in many cases, quite direct contact with their Member of Parliament, and that was really their contact into the government rather than line ministries. And people also suggested that that they elected MPs on the basis of material returns which they could get. So they preferred to elect, in some cases, an MP who had demonstrated a track record of giving them material supplies versus somebody who makes a policy promise which had a lot of uncertainty around it. So the formal institutions of state are relatively, well, they form... they're a competing authority within the lives of most Solomon Islanders, so they also sit alongside traditional forms of governance and the roles of the church. In 2014, which the research mostly focused on, MPs controlled around $56 million Australian dollars in discretionary funds. So there isn't a strong track record of those funds being accountable. And also... therefore, kind of the vaguely defined purpose of development activities, but that's not really outlined on and defined too well on how those are spent. When MPs get involved in the role of project implementers, like what happened in disaster response, but also what happens during peacetime as well, it can create some tension between their role as implementers and as legislators, because they are in a position to pass legislation which they can directly benefit from. So in response to the floods, the assistance was programmed through MPs, and they were given funds to respond in their constituencies. And when questions were raised around that, the previous Prime Minister, Gordon Darcy-Lilo, justified that, saying that the NDMO, the National Disaster Office, is quite a bureaucratic organisation and doesn't always live up to public expectations. I looked at a few different precedents for the use of the constituency as a vehicle for relief supplies. And a couple of them, the Auditor-General and Solomon Islands, had actually looked into. The first being an earthquake in 2007, and there have been reports that, well, there wasn't a whole lot of accountability over those funds. And in 2014, relating to the flood, the Auditor-General had written a report on that, but that hasn't yet been released. And some of the participants had reflected that the Auditor-General had been removed or his contract had been terminated, and they reflected that they weren't sure if that was primarily because of the reason which was given, that he had passed the compulsory retirement age, or that he was about to release that report, which could have implicated some of the sitting politicians. And during the time that I was conducting the research, there was a tropical cyclone, quite a low category, and the NDMO had gone to Cabinet to request a contingency warrant to respond, and that was actually rejected in favour of giving those funds to MPs to respond in their constituencies instead. So as a result, there were already assessment teams out in affected areas, and the NDMO actually pulled back those assessment teams, so it did cause a bit of hold-up in the response as well. So I guess I'm interested in posing a few questions. Without having any formal process of needs assessment and to decide what are the needs on the ground, what is the most appropriate supplies or assistance relief to be giving, then how can the differentiated needs within the constituency be responded to? Then there's also a big question of, can MPs respond better than the NDMO to disaster? And lastly, what comes of those who don't support the sitting MP? So a couple of people who I'd interviewed were happy to go on record with their comments. One was the chair of a civil society group called Forum Solomon Islands International, which is quite popular, and they're based on Facebook and have about 20,000 members. And he said that that the MP's assistance was highly political, and candidates tend to support who would vote for them, and that sitting MPs clearly do this. The supplies were only for their voters. The campaigning candidates used the opportunity to build their profile, and it was just before the national elections, which happened later that year, and so they're essentially campaigning during the floods by dishing out supplies. So I think the role that MPs play is also stepping into a void of service delivery. Where there are weak state institutions, MPs are they're locals, they're representing their constituencies, and so they're the most, in some cases, the most accessible arm of government. A number of academics, as well as people I interviewed, have reflected that MPs are seen as ATMs, people to go to for assistance, be it for a boat fare, support for a funeral, or medicines and the like. So instead of following what we would have in Australia of government line ministries, MPs are really that accessible form for distribution, like assistance, rather than long-term programming. And MPs being selected on their credentials as locals. I think looking through the current sitting MPs, there's some who haven't completed high school education or are ministers of ministries which they haven't held a formal job before. But in people's voting decisions, a lot of people reflected that it was their credentials as locals and their track record of supporting their constituencies, which was the basis that they were voted into power. Constituency development funds and the channeling of resources through government obviously has issues with creating perceptions that that's the way of doing government and governance. So overall, I'd just like to sum up by saying that MPs have stepped into a void of service delivery, and that can also bring challenges for them in that when they are in such a role of having control over resources and having constituents knock at their door for all kinds of things, it does make their job as policymakers quite difficult. When their assistance lacks any kind of consistency and coordination with other stakeholders in a disaster space, not cooperating with other NGOs, not cooperating with the NDMO or other donors, it can create some issues of overlap of response and who's receiving what and how much. Obviously, those funds aren't really accounted for very well, and there's no way to evaluate the effectiveness of those responses. And lastly, the sidelining of the National Disaster Council is quite concerning because they're the institution which is designed to be responding to disasters, and when their mandate is undermined, it's both demoralising for the staff there, but also doesn't bode well for their future budgeting for other disasters and being able to respond in those cases. And that's me. Thanks.
Thank you, Carl, and there's a number of both stats and findings there that I myself have found surprising, particularly the $54 million of funding that's actually channeled through MPs is a very large amount of money. But also, I think, as you've touched on, the whole question around in the context of Solomon's, you know, what is the role now but in the future of formal institutions that are given responsibility or mandate to manage humanitarian assistance over and against the political realities of MPs and the WANTOC sort of system. I'm sure sort of leading into the Red Cross presentation, there's various questions around impartiality and neutrality that sort of come with all of that as well. But look, maybe we've got 5-10 minutes for questions for Carl. He's posed a number of questions, which I sort of see both as much questions to himself as to you. I'd ask if you do want to make a comment, keep it very brief, but with the time available and considering the research that Carl's and the team's done, appreciate if you can sort of focus the question on some of the points that Carl's particularly raised. So, open to you.
Carl,
maybe just briefly say, sorry, who you are and the question.
Yeah, so Simon Ernst from DCAT in the evaluation area. Your presentation was called MPs as Humanitarians. Mm. So I think you could have just as easily put a question mark at the end of that.
And then by
the end of the presentation, I mean, you stop short of saying that, but essentially when you do think about the humanitarian principles, I mean, you did systematically go through, but many of those humanitarian principles that we'd be familiar with aren't really being acknowledged, I guess. So why did you stop short of making, I guess, a bold conclusion there about whether, in fact, MPs can be considered humanitarians?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, and it was actually something that I was considering. One thing that I didn't mention in that was one of the groups in the settlement beside the Matanego River actually saw the MP's assistance as the best assistance that they had received from any party. And that was because following the disaster, they had actually been put up in a motel accommodation by the MP. And so they said that was great for protection issues. Elderly people and children had a place to stay. It also helped with the trauma while their houses and community was damaged. But at the very same time, neighbouring members of that community who are from Malaita didn't receive that assistance, and they were impacted just in the same or in similar ways. And their assistance was they were able to purchase noodles at $10 a box. So, yeah, obviously there's those equity issues there, but it's also in the minds of those people who are part of the focus groups. And in some cases, they thought that MPs were actually quite good responders to disaster.
Thank you very much. That was a terrific presentation and such valuable down-into-the-weeds issues there. I guess my question is, if NDMO or NDC is being sidelined and perhaps part of the rapid package of assistance the Australian government can provide is direct funding to an NDMO, where is the... is it $54 million Australian dollars or...
Yeah, Australian dollars.
Where is that money... how are MPs being receiving 50 MPs receiving?
Yeah, well, a lot of that is from untagged budgets, and one of the I guess controversial stakeholders in this is the Taiwan government. So Solomon Islands is one of the few countries who recognises Taiwan, and they give significant funds, and actually some of it is directly towards constituency development funds. They're also the only participant who didn't want to be involved in the research, who was approached. And I think a majority of the institutional stakeholders, at least, had discussed about their role in that. Before the floods happened, there was they were starting to improve on accountability, actually asking for, I guess, to acquit those funds. But then when the disaster happened, it was a bit of a bold call to be asking for that, so that had sort of dropped away and hasn't really been picked up since.
Thank you. Great presentation. Peter Walton from Red Cross. So, yeah, as I was listening, you know, at times shaking my head around this politicising of humanitarian aid and fundamental principles, and felt that the questions at the end were sort of rhetorical, because I think there's a lot in there. But I was intrigued by one point you raised around MPs stepping into a void, which almost like they're trying to fill a gap, versus what I guess one of the other people said earlier around the sort of some of the formal institutions being actively prevented from playing the role that they should. And I just think it came to get your perspective on what you think that means for leadership within Solomon Islands, especially given the grand bargain, localisation, and the role of local actors.
I think there's a dual question in that, really, and one is, what is the void that they're stepping into? And it, potentially that's one of service delivery, but it could also be one of just you know, economic gaps, like where people are actually requesting assistance in particular forms. But the other one is looking at the role which they play as actors in a Westminster system of government, which MPs really act as in a role as policymakers, but also wearing the hat of traditional forms of governance and acting as big men in the communities who are expected to distribute state resources in that kind of way. So I don't know if I really have an answer to your question, but I think there's a tension at the constituency level over which role they play, a role of formal representatives to the government, or as a role of those ATMs, really, of bringing state resources down to the constituency.
All right, thank you. Bill, and then we might go there, and then we might need to move on. But Bill
Armstrong from the past. My question's from the past. In the 80s and 90s, the Australian government and NGOs, Red Cross and a number of organisations spent an enormous amount of money and time in the Pacific and in the Solomon Islands working on preparation for disaster relief. And I just wonder, Carl, whether there's any evidence of any of that still there, and if not, why not? Why aren't those mechanisms actually able to be brought into play?
I think there were some interesting ways of well, the ways that people exhibited resilience in response to the disaster. So, you know, the way, the patterns in which people in rural areas planted crops and had places where crops could be quick harvested before a disaster. So people were responding in that kind of way. But also it runs into some challenges around land tenure, which is obviously a big issue in Solomon Islands, and people who are along the river, those areas which shouldn't have been built on in the first place. Well, the government and council have required that people don't rebuild on those, but there's houses along there since the floods as well. So I think the issue of risk reduction also runs into the issues of land tenure and the desire of people to reside in Honiara for economic opportunities, but really can't gain access to land there.
Great, thanks. So we'll have one more, and then there will be opportunity at the very end to ask a couple more, but we might move on to the next speaker. Please, back.
Funding mechanism through MPs isn't going to go anywhere in a hurry. It's quite a robust feature of Solomon Islands politics and PNG. So have you got any thoughts on how, if you want to say, particularly humanitarian actors can engage with this mechanism to make it more impartial and more neutral?
Well, I think there's a few measures which can be taken in place. For a start, times when there's been an Auditor General's report, it would be great to actually see, in the case of those floods, to see the evidence from that report and what its findings have been. I also think that for donors, particularly Taiwan, who are inputting into those funds, they can be asking for those funds to be acquitted, so having a bit more accountability around that. And then I guess I'm going to pose another rhetorical question, is around whether MPs are humanitarian actors to be engaged with following disaster. If they're not going anywhere, should organisations be looking to at least coordinate formally or informally with the work that they're doing and try and move them along the spectrum from very ad hoc assistance and potentially quite politicised of just supporting supporters to a more well-designed response to emergencies.
Great. Well, thank you, Carl, and also thank you for all the questions. I think it sort of really provokes some important questions, not just for how we deliver assistance in the Pacific, but more broadly. To move on to the second presentation, Olivia Warwick is from Red Cross, is a senior climate advisor for the international programs, work within the Red Cross. DFAT has a very long-standing partnership with Red Cross. It's been imposing having the Red Cross panel up there. We have a partnership which has really had a much stronger focus in recent years about how we better invest in planning investment before, so it's great to have this presentation that looks at some of the things that emerge from that and how it may both inform the work of donors like ourselves, but also NGOs, national governments, etc. So, Olivia, over to you.
Thanks so much, Jamie. I also have come over from New Zealand, so it's good to see some good Kiwi representation in the room here. So I work with the Red Cross Red Crescent Climate Centre, which is a global team that provides technical support both to the Red Cross movement but also its partners on developing tools and approaches in the space of making better use of climate science for climate smart decision making. And forecast-based financing, which I'm going to present today, is one such approach to this. It's a method that we developed to address some of the challenges that we were observing in our work in getting people to take action based on early warning information. So the Red Cross at the moment supports 8 forecast-based financing pilots in other regions of the world. And last year, the Climate Centre partnered with the Australian Red Cross with the support of DFAT and also SPRET, the Pacific Regional Environment Programme, to undertake a scoping study to look at how feasible would this approach be here in the Pacific. So I'm going to focus today on, first of all, outlining what the method is, the forecast-based financing, and then outlining some, I guess, key headline findings from that scoping study. Now, what is forecast-based financing? I'm going to cheat a little bit here and just play an animation that sums it up quite nicely. Oops, but I don't seem to have sound. Is there a plug that I need to plug in?
Just turn it down.
Oh.
That should be
next. All sorts of things.
Right, thank you.
But this doesn't need to happen, at least not to the degree it does now. Let's try something new. We're proposing a new way of working, a system called forecast-based financing. So let's talk about what we do now. In everyday life, someone has information about what might happen in the next few days or weeks. For example, storm forecasts or flood forecasts. Every once in a while, risk information is very high. Right now, nothing happens. People might be worried, but life continues on as always. People are busy and have no idea what to do with this random information. But then, bam, an extreme event happens. Of course, there's chaos and distress. Lots of responders show up to help. Many donors also get involved and oversee the response. So they feel like they're doing their mission. They spend huge amounts of money, huge populations are devastated, and spend years recovering. This is our normal. We go through this over and over again. But finally, people started saying, wait a second, this is ridiculous. We're smarter than this. We can see the warning. Why aren't we doing anything? Which leads us to forecast-based financing. Let's give our stick figure a plan and associated funding. This is our forecast-based financing system. The plan means when the risk information gets to red, action is automatically taken. Some donors come on board who agree they will put in money when the risk is red, before the potential disaster. Okay, so what could happen? When the risk information turns red, those plans are automatically triggered. Resources are deployed, but the event doesn't happen. All of those resources are spent on preparedness for naught, the shame. Donors are disappointed because they spent money that didn't end up being used to a purpose. But no one is hurt. This might make you think, why would I do this? What a waste. But not so fast. Let's look at another day in the life of the system. So the risk information turns red. This time, just like before, plans are triggered. Remember, this is automatic because we have the plan. Resources are deployed, and bam, this time an extreme event happens. But this time, the catastrophe is averted. Donors are thrilled. By only spending a small amount of money, there's an incredible return on investment. Very few people are affected by the disaster. Having this system is way better than no system, even though the system will occasionally trigger action in vain. For the most preventative action, you will need to act in vain many times before the figures would add up to the cost of suffering just one round of sticking to our current lack of planning. What would you prefer? Let's be smarter about how we do response. Let's not just know what might happen. Let's act, too.
Okay. So let's get this back. All right, so as most of you probably know, the Red Cross has been working in the space of early warning, early action for a long time. Okay. We know that there are many humanitarian actions that can be effective to be implemented in this window of time that you have available between a forecast and a potential disaster. But what we're noticing is that often these actions are not taken to the extent that they could be. And why is this? Institutional learning within the movement has shown us that there's a couple of key bottlenecks. One is a lack of funding that can be used in this window of time. And the other is a lack of operational protocols or institutional mandates for actually taking action based on climate information. So just to kind of, I guess, dig into the elements of the forecast-based financing system in a little more depth, as you probably picked up from the animation, there are three core elements. There's a specific climate and or weather forecasts. And these are forecasts that represent a probability of an event of a certain magnitude that causes a lot of problems for people occurring. So, for example, a 20% chance of a 1 in 10-year flood. Importantly, it also contains actions. So these are actions that actually make sense to be done in that window of time. And these can be along a spectrum from either early disaster preparedness type actions with the aim of mitigating the potential impact of the disaster through to early response actions. So early preparedness actions would be things like, for example, stockpiling food, undertaking awareness actions, planting drought-resilient crops. Early response would be basically making sure that people have relief items in hand or, you know, resources in hand earlier than they would otherwise without this climate information. So, for example, pre-disaster distribution of hygiene kits as opposed to in the disaster response phase. Now, you probably picked up from the animation also that forecasts are not 100% certain. Okay, that's the nature of a forecast. That's what it does. Sometimes within the system, you would spend money based on a forecast and the disaster would not occur. Okay, so that's, I guess, what we call the acting in vain principle. Now, the idea is that if you calibrate the entire system well over the long term, the costs of occasionally acting in vain are outweighed by the cost savings that you get from preparing as opposed to just responding. To calibrate this system correctly, you need to very carefully match your actions with your forecast probabilities. So as a general rule, actions that are low regret, so reasonably low cost or worth doing anyway, would be matched with forecasts that have a reasonably low probability. On the other hand, actions that are much higher cost, higher regret, you'd need to be pretty sure that your disaster was going to happen to actually invest in those pre-disaster actions. Okay, so the third and perhaps, maybe most fundamental element is the fund, okay, because this is the oil in the system that actually enables those actions to be undertaken. So the forecast-based financing system requires setting up a dedicated preparedness fund that can be automatically triggered when forecasts are received. So, I mean, a lot of these things we already do in the pre-disaster phase in, I guess, a more sort of ad hoc, less systematic way. One of the key value adds of the FBF system is that it's all encapsulated in a standard operating procedure. So it is an automatic system. All of the decisions about resource allocations and how much you're willing to spend based on information are worked out well in advance. So, probably the part that you're most interested in is what we found in the Pacific. So our Pacific scoping study focused in Fiji, Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands. And to undertake the study, we developed a set of criteria for where, I guess, to assess where forecast-based financing would be the most suitable, not just here in the Pacific, but anywhere. So these criteria, I guess, develop rigour around how you choose locations and hazards, etc., for FBF. Look, because of time constraints, I'm not going to go through these criteria in detail. I'm happy to share if anyone is interested. Suffice to say, they focus around these key questions. So you need to know what your forecasting skill is for various hazards. You need to know what the risks are associated with the hazards and which areas are most vulnerable. What early actions do actually add value above and beyond what you're doing already? What's the interest and buy-in of key in-country institutions? And importantly, do they have the capacity to take on an FBF system? And what existing programs, such as social protection systems, early warning systems, or DRR programs, could FBF slot into? It's not designed to be a standalone project or program. It needs to be knitted onto something. So what did we find? Look, I'm just going to present here, I guess, a few key interesting findings from the scoping study that perhaps represent some unique factors in the Pacific that we need to take into account. There is a 70-page report that outlines the findings in detail. So, again, if anyone's interested, please be in touch. Look, the overall take-home message, I think, from the scoping study is that, yes, FBF does fill an important niche here in the Pacific. What organisations are observing is that over time, capability in the supply side of climate information has really grown. And this is thanks to, you know, a number of really great regional programs that have built up the capacity of Met Services and their partner NDMOs to produce accurate climate forecasting information and even disseminate it. What we're seeing, though, is that there is still quite a significant gap in our capability to tailor that information to specific end-user needs, sector end-user needs, and in particular community end-user needs, and also to the capability to actually uptake and use that information and undertake actions is a gap. And it comes, again, back to these two factors, lack of funding, lack of institutional protocols. So what hazards are likely to be the most feasible for FBF in the Pacific? Look, drought is a bit of a low-hanging fruit here in the Pacific for a couple of reasons. One, it is pretty highly forecastable, so National Met Services are pretty comfortable with their ability to predict drought based on seasonal forecasts matched with observations of rainfall. For drought, because of its slow-onset nature, you can also integrate triggers that are observed. So, for example, what's happening with the crops wilting or livestock health, for example. The other reason, in addition to it being highly forecastable, is that it's also a black hole in terms of action. So we really saw this leading up to the 2015-16 El Niño, and in the early stages of the El Niño even, there was a lack of understanding about what actually to do to prepare, and there was certainly a lack of funding available for supporting preparedness. Can we do FBF for tropical cyclones, given how impactful they are here in the Pacific and how much they cost the region? Yes, probably, but it requires quite a lot more analysis and thinking. The situation you have in the Pacific is basically that because of small land masses, you would only have high certainty about where a cyclone was going to make landfall at a lead time of 1, perhaps 2 days. What the situation that may evolve if you do FBF for tropical cyclones is that you would be triggering in vain too often for it to be worth it. But something that requires a bit more analysis and looking into. Can we do it for floods? Yes, probably in a few years. Right now in the Pacific, there's a lack of hydrological modelling capability because there's a lack of hydro data. Hydrological departments tend to be pretty low capacity, and also because of the way that catchments behave, flood modelling is problematic. There are a number of key regional investments that are building up this capability. So a few years down the track, yeah, this would probably be a good option. What about actions? How does, I guess, FBF add value on the action side of things? Look, one kind of unique thing that came out of the Pacific Scoping Study was the high relevance of institutional-level preparedness actions. So in most of the other pilots, FBF has been focused very much at the community scale. But what we see here in the Pacific is that many humanitarian agencies lack resources pre-disaster to be able to undertake core functions like driving around to do awarenesses, credit for the phones, that kind of thing. So that could fill a key niche. What we see also is that there are many community level, you know, as we know, communities have, particularly in remoter areas, really well-developed coping strategies already. FBF could add value to that by assisting communities to know when to do key activities like planting drought-resilient crops, for example. Remoteness, obviously, in this region is a really important consideration when you're looking at the time and the cost that it would take to ship goods. You really need to work that into the forecasts that you choose in terms of probability and lead time. Just to finish up on, I guess, institutions and partnership opportunities, one of the key questions is there interest and buy-in potentially from key organisations? And the answer is yes. Everybody is very interested in FBF in the Pacific, you know, a range of institutions, crop agencies, UN agencies, donors. I guess there's recognition that it does fill an important niche. Something that came out very strongly during the consultations is that there is great scope in the Pacific to embed it, I've been told to stop, in a government system. And that is indeed the end game. We need to build an evidence base to get us to that point. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Olivia. I mean, I think one level sort of, we all know at one point investing before is a much more effective and critical approach than responding during or investing during, but I think Olivia's presentation goes really further in highlighting some interesting areas about what that might actually look like practically. What does it mean in terms of how we develop those investments at community level, how it is engaged with government on the policy level. So thank you for that. As sort of a bit of a, using the chair's opportunity to pitch, just to flag that it is an area the Australian government's putting a fair bit of effort into. We've got a $36 million partnership with the Red Cross, which has a very strong focus on all this investment and preparedness before. We've got a new $50 million over the next 5 years partnership with the Australian NGO networks to look at this whole issue around the investment on risk reduction and preparation and planning on this, beyond what we're trying to do in relation to how we partner better with governments, both the NDMOs but private sector on this. We certainly have the answers on it, but I think one of the things is we acknowledge that we need to have the investment and partnerships to sort of take that forward. So thank you for this. I'll certainly be taking
Thanks, Jamie, back to
my colleagues to feed that through as well. So I'll open up for questions. We've got, again, about 5-10 minutes to ask Olivia, same points briefing, but just who you are, and then if you can sort of focus your question or very brief comment on Olivia's presentation.
Thanks for a very insightful presentation. My name's Phoebe Hammond, and I work for the International Planned Parenthood Federation. I think it's a very relevant topic at the moment, and I just wondered if you could potentially elaborate briefly on maybe a successful example of what this has looked like in the Pacific, particularly in the context of the health sector in extremely remote and rural communities.
Well, we haven't done it in the Pacific yet. So, I mean, this is, I guess, the point of the scoping study was to identify feasible options, and the next phase of work in partnership with the Australian Red Cross is to go through a design phase with support from DFAT. Thank you, DFAT. So I can give you an example, though, I guess, from one of the other pilot regions. So in Bangladesh, we have an FBF program for floods, which is a purely cash transfer system. Look, in that context, cash transfer is it's the most feasible action based on the consultations with communities. And what we've demonstrated in that project is, well, we've done some early analysis, which is showing that a cash transfer of, I think it's 60 euros 3 days before a flood, as opposed to spending that 60 euros in cash transfer after the flood, is actually reducing household losses from, I think it's 700 euros to 300 euros. And that's because people have cash in hand to evacuate livestock, to reinforce houses, and importantly to access medical care earlier than they would otherwise so they can return to work more quickly. And that, I guess that saving also represents this acting in vain principle, so that's worked into it. So, I mean, look, that's early analysis. The pilot project actually has to trigger before we can test whether or not that pans out, but the results at the moment look pretty promising.
Yes, sorry.
I'm Jo Peebles from DFAT. I work on social protection. I'm just interested to know what your assessment of forecast-based financing in the city said around the social protection systems and how
Yeah, that's a really great question. There's actually a group within the Climate Centre that is looking specifically at FBF in the context of social protection. It's something that we, I guess, discussed at the early stages of this scoping study, but didn't really take further, I guess, at that point because many countries, I guess, don't have established social protection systems that an FBF system could kind of slot into. I guess Fiji being the exception. And I know that the World Bank have invested quite a lot recently in, I think, social protection in Fiji. So that might be something to look into a bit further down the track. But let's get in touch afterwards, and I can put you in touch with my colleagues that are looking specifically at adding this climate smart social protection element into FBF.
Yes, Olivia. Sorry, the back, and then is there one over you? Is it?
Over here.
Oh, sorry. Okay, one at the back, and then I'll come.
Yeah, sure, and you're certainly not the only one who's been asking that question. I guess the stage that we're at the moment with FBF is very much kind of a piloting phase. So the, I guess the parameters of a financing mechanism is really something that that at the moment we're putting a lot more research into. So we're partnering with the Frankfurt School of Economics, who are you know doing a specific body of work for us around looking at feasible financing instruments, so insurance type mechanisms for FBF. So I guess I can't really offer too much in way of answer to your question other than to say that at the moment, basically we use whatever kind of public financing we can just to demonstrate the concept, and as it grows and evolves and we learn lessons, that can, you know, expand into something, I guess, a lot more kind of complex and concrete.
Yeah, a
good question just about whether you're aware of any work done to use this type of modelling in other humanitarian crises, like not necessarily climate-related.
Mm. No, I'm not aware. But that's a really great question. Yeah, no, that's... I guess you're thinking in terms of conflict and... as opposed
conflict,
to disaster,
outbreaks, like... Ebola type.
Yeah. Yeah. Great question. I'm afraid I don't have an answer.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Well, thank you. Well, look, moving on to sort of protracted and conflict situations, we might move on to the third presentation. As much as I love New Zealanders for the benefit of diversity, I'm hoping, Rimmel Cuddy, that you're not from New Zealand. Rimmel Cuddy is doing has done some research. He's a research associate here at ANU, has done research, particularly looking at around the issues of provision of education services to Syrian refugees in Lebanon. But over to you. Okay.
Thank you. So yes, my name is Rimmel Cuddy, a research associate with the Development Policy Centre here at ANU, and my talk today is on the Syrian refugee crisis, the macro and micro perspectives of donor education in Lebanon, a work in research that I'm collaborating on with colleagues from University of Adelaide. A bit of background on the crisis, the diagram on the right side of the screen, not very clear, but basically it summarizes the timeline of the crisis, which started in 2011 with civil protests in Syria turning into violent fighting between government and rebel groups. The red bubble on the top represents the first 5,000, it marks the 5,000 Syrian refugees who arrived in 2011 at the start of the crisis in Lebanon, and that number quickly grew to become 1 million in 2014. Today it's estimated that the number of the internally displaced Syrians is 6.3 million, and the number of refugees is over 4.8 million refugees. Those refugees have mostly settled in countries neighboring Syria. So looking at the map in the middle, those countries include Turkey, Iraq, Jordan, Egypt, and Lebanon. Lebanon is the smallest of those countries, and currently it hosts the second highest number of refugees after Turkey. The map to the left shows the distribution of the Syrian refugees across the Lebanese territory. So pretty much the size of the blue dots represent the concentration of the Syrian refugees, and they're pretty much across the whole Lebanese territory. It's estimated that over 40% of the Lebanese villages and municipalities have now more Syrians than Lebanese. And although the number of officially registered refugees with the UNHCR is estimated to be a bit over 1 million. Effectively, the number is estimated by both donor organizations and the Lebanese government to be well in excess of 1.5 million, more around the 1.8 million figure. For Lebanon, the total population now is estimated to be 6 million, and it is estimated that one in three So every third person is actually a refugee, either a Syrian refugee or a Palestinian refugee, because Lebanon already is host to a large population of Syrian refugees due to the conflict between, like, in Palestine and Israel. The map to the right represents the 251 localities that have been identified out of a survey conducted by the donors in collaboration with the Lebanese government. And those localities currently comprise 87% of the Syrian refugees, 67% of poor Lebanese, and 92% of Palestinian refugees. And they have been identified as they're currently the focus of most of the assistance programs and initiatives. Syrian refugees have settled in urban areas. Over 20% of those refugees have settled in poor, urban, and deprived areas. The impact on the social, the impact on the services sectors across the board is huge. Obviously, whether it's in public health, water, the provision of water and sanitation services, solid waste disposal, and across all public services, basically. The influx of refugees has resulted in an increase of 50% since 2011 in the Lebanese workforce, and it's estimated that over 50% of vulnerable Lebanese seeking low-wage jobs has increased, an increase of 50% of vulnerable Lebanese seeking low-wage jobs has been recorded since 2011. The World Bank has estimated the cost to the Lebanese economy to be over $7.5 billion so far, and estimates are that 52% indicate that 52% of the Syrian refugees and 10% of the Lebanese population currently live in extreme poverty, under less than $2.4 a day. For the education sector, more than 50% of the Syrian refugees in Lebanon are children between the age between 3 and 17 years old, so, and it's estimated that over 250,000 of those children are actually out of are not attending school. The decision from the very beginning of the crisis, the onset of the crisis, the Ministry of Education and Higher Education in Lebanon took the decision to absorb the Syrian refugees' children in the public schooling system, basically by introducing afternoon shifts mostly. The integration there were a number of integration challenges for those Syrian children. In a study in 2013 showed that the failure rate was twice the national average, and there was a high dropout rate. The barriers are many, and I will discuss them in more details in the next slide, but they include barriers related to the curriculum, including administrative-related barriers, such as providing paperwork required to register in the schools, lost schooling year, but most importantly, language was an issue for the integration of the Syrian children, because while Lebanon and Syria share the same national language, which is Arabic, in Lebanon, half of the curriculum is actually delivered in either French or English, which is not the case in Syria. This was a major barrier for the integration of children, of the Syrian students in the public schooling system. The social and economic challenges are many, and I will discuss them in more details in the next slide, as well as safety and security. This slide actually highlights the challenges from the social perspective, both from the perspective of the within the Syrian communities, but also the tension points between the Syrian communities and the refugee communities. And the tension points are many, including political polarization, competition across the provision and or access to public and private goods and services, so including housing, the labor market, even aid and subsidies, as well as the pressure that was exerted due to the massive influx on public and municipal services. Legal status of the Syrian refugees is also an important factor in this, because Lebanon is not a signatory of the Refugee Convention due to past history with the Palestinian refugees. So Syrian refugees struggle with the legal organizing or regularizing their legal status. The Syrian refugee children also face challenges like child labor, early marriage for girls, domestic violence. The table to the right actually is from a study done by International Alert and nicely summarizes the interactions and relationships at the school context, within the school context, so between students and between parents, and comparing the interactions between mixed classes and segregated classes where the students are separated in morning and afternoon shifts. And it shows that there's a lot of caution, and not really no real social integration. The Lebanese response to the crisis, the Lebanese government, with the assistance of donors, put together a Lebanon crisis response plan to basically submit the requirements to the donors' communities. The way the delivery of the LCRP is managed through a governance structure which is headed by the Ministry of Social Affairs and with the UN. A number of intersectoral working groups also exist, and there's also the vertical delivery governance which goes through for individual sectors. So for education, the Ministry of Education and Health manages the delivery with in collaboration with UNICEF. The education component of the Lebanon Crisis Response Plan is the Reaching All Children with Education. The Ministry of Education came up with the first version that ran from 2014 to 2016, and now they propose to the donors' community a 5-year plan instead of two to respond to the massive increase in the demand for school seats, basically, and it addresses improved access, improved quality, but also in trying to enhance and enable the systems within the ministry. There's an increased focus on from the donors' community on the resilience component, because what started with that sort of 5,000 refugees has now become a protracted crisis, and sort of driving and supporting all the rhetoric about building resilience. The diagram on the right shows how the amounts required have increased year on year. The component to the in orange is actually the Syrian aid, the part of the required aid inside Syria. The green part is the for the region, the aid required for the region, which is a bigger component. For Lebanon, and as it appears by the darker green, the funded part of the required aid is below what is required by the countries. For Lebanon, it has run around 50%. The graph below to the left is actually the component, the aid required for the education sector, which amounts to $2.1 billion for the next 5 years. I wanted to touch on the role of NGOs, which is very important in outreach and delivery, particularly in the delivery of non-formal education. The challenges that they face, they often mention lengthy vetting procedures, because this is aid going to Syria, remember, and Syrian. absence of multi-year planning and also issues around efficiencies and coordination. So is the picture all black and gloomy? Despite the huge number of children who are still out of school, still the graph on the right shows that year on year there has been a massive improvement in enrollment. The Ministry of Education has really stepped up capacity. The number of afternoon shifts, the number of schools offering afternoon shifts has been increased from 89 to 330 in 4 years. So the ministry is really trying hard to accommodate this massive influx. But this has also been supported by a range of initiatives, including fee waiver in schools, cash programs, increased awareness about available assistance and other support activities important to enable students to attend school. For the Lebanese government, there's this resilience component represents actually a bit of good in this gloomy picture, and the influx of aid could be an opportunity, and is the government is trying to use that as an opportunity to provide increased training for public school teachers, initiate a review of the curriculum, and rehabilitate a number of schools that needed basic improvement in basic services. On that note, thank you.